Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 316 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. I'm joined this week by Cosmo Jarvis. I was really excited about this. I've been trying to line Cosmo up for ages, and he feels like a bit of an enigma because I've not heard him do tons of stuff. A lot of you, if you heard the Florence Pugh podcast ages ago, I was a huge fan, and my Films of the Year podcast the year before that, I was a huge fan of a film called Lady Macbeth. We talk about it in this episode. And Cosmo and Florence were just the two people who just I'd never heard of or never seen anywhere, and they both blew me away. So when Cosmo then popped up in Peaky Blinders, one of my favourite shows, and the performance he gave, I was like, this dude. And then I got to go and see a preview of Calm with Horses, his new film, which is probably in the cinemas now or on Friday, but in cinemas soon or now. And it's honestly, it's a jaw-dropping performance from Cosmo. You're going to be blown away. I can't recommend you getting out to the cinema to see it enough. People often say that my Films of the Year list opens them up to a lot of films, but normally films that are now, by the time the Films of the Year list comes out, are on demand or whatever else, and they're kind of gutted that they miss it in the cinema. I'm telling you, this is going to be on my Films of the Year list. I'm confident. And I do a list of, what is it, 12 I do, or 16 or something. There's no way I'm going to see 15 films better than this year. It's fantastic. So anyway, that's what's going on here. If this is your first episode, then you might want to go back and check out last week's episode with Niamh Algar. Hopefully there won't be too much crossover in points I make about Calm with Horses, because she's one of Cosmo's co-stars. I'm going to stop rambling. You can get my music from speechdevelopmentrecords.com. I mentioned at the end of the episode with Niamh that I'm not sure if it's on the recording or not. You'll hear at the end, Buddy Peace edits everything together. But there was a point where we finished the podcast and Cosmo quoted a lyric at me from a song of mine called The Struggle, and I proper kind of become a giggly schoolgirl. Because we'd proper hit it off, but again, I never have the assumption that anyone who comes on the podcast has any idea who I am. It genuinely isn't something that ever seems to cross my mind. But he quoted one of my lyrics at me, and I was like, oh, shit, cool, man. Okay. See, so you've got that awkwardness to look forward to at the end. But the record that song is from is out now on Glow in the Dark vinyl, if we've got any left, at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. So yeah, there's that. You do you. You don't need it, but if you want it, go and get it. All right, let's get on with the podcast. This is, as mentioned, episode 316 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Cosmo Jarvis. I'm here with Cosmo Jarvis. How's it going, man?
Not too bad.
Good. We've just started to do the sound check thing on the mics, talking about pizzas. And,
yeah.
You know, you touched upon how it's kind of weird with Domino's or any of these big brands. If you want anything basic, you're not really getting your money's worth. If you want to get, like, two pizzas, five sides, ice cream,
yeah,
the desserts, that's the only place you get value.
It's that's not really the only place you're going to get absolutely stuffed.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So often the kinds of more, I don't know what you'd call them, what the appropriate wording would be, but the special pizzas.
Yeah.
The nice sit-down pizzas.
Yeah.
With olives, that come with olives and little bits of bread and stuff.
Yeah.
They're usually, I can't justify £8 for that.
Nah, it's a bit outrageous, isn't it?
Because you're still going to snack afterwards. I am.
Yeah. Completely. And legit, whenever I've been, like, in Europe and you find the typical basic Italian restaurant, they'll have pizza for, like, €4 and it'll be this huge, beautiful, the most tasty pizza you'll ever have.
Yeah.
And then if you want it kind of over here, it's £12.
Yeah, but also, why is it that the pizzas, like, I had a job a while ago in New York, and the pizza there was, like, you know, wholesome, big. It was a big piece. It was a big piece. And then it was, like, a dollar in some cases, dollar for... Here, that's, like, £4 for the same quality of pizza and the same conveniently available pizza.
It's weird, isn't it? The places that are better at pizza have it a lot cheaper, and the places that are worse at it charge you through the teeth for it.
It's annoying.
Just before we started, you had to inject yourself. You're diabetic.
Type 1 insulin-dependent diabetic.
How do you find that with work, with acting and with things like that? Is it something that you have to keep an eye on or manage?
It's, yeah, you do. A lot of people who have it, I've had it since I was 2, a lot of people who have it are much better at being on top of it than I am.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I was younger finding out that Halle Berry had it, which was pretty cool.
That's
like,
amazing.
And loads of people have got it now. It's one of those things that's just going to kill humanity. But the juvenile kind, it's just, you just got to test your blood all the time and then inject the appropriate amount of medication for whatever kind of food you're eating. So it's better to eat things with no carbohydrate in, but that's really hard.
Yeah, particularly on set, right? When there's catering and... Yeah,
cakes and crisps and sausage sandwiches.
Or everywhere will seem to... Every set these days will seem to have quite a diverse lunch options, right? So you'll be covered there, but it's those in-between periods when you're having to wait around and there's, like, the coffee bit has just got cakes and biscuits and all the stuff that you can't really
penguins.
Fuck with. Yeah, exactly.
But I do mess with it.
You
and
can't
I shouldn't.
Resist.
And it just creates so many problems. But, there are ways of getting around it. You can still munch out being a diabetic. And it's just not as... Yeah, I do have those moments where I'm just like, fuck it, like, massive thing of ice cream.
Get me my pen.
Yeah, get me my pen.
Bring me my pen. It's going to be a long evening.
Empty the entire cartridge into my stomach in one go.
Yeah, as you're walking down the freezer aisle. Let's just commit now.
In advance, yeah.
I mean, we're here to talk about Calm with Horses, which I do want to talk about because I saw it a month or two ago now, and it's jumped into a front runner for one of my films of the year already. I absolutely adored it. But I want to talk about your journey there as well, because the first thing I saw you in was Lady Macbeth.
Oh, whoa.
And it blew me away. It's weird to tell a story about myself here, but I was on set, because I moved from music into acting. Like, we've got a similar journey in that way. And I'd been called to set, and I was sitting in the car with Chris Fairbank, who was in it. And
he's a legend.
He's got the best stories ever. I had him on this podcast, and we had to do 2 episodes because he just had so many stories. But I'm sitting in the car.
His Batman stories, mental.
Yes. He's got so many. His alien ones. He was one I'd just sit with on set and go, just tell me stuff, man.
Yeah.
But I was in the car, and just as we were about to leave, they said, oh, we don't need you today. So I got out and looked, and I'd wanted to see Lady Macbeth, and I saw it was on at a cinema in Leeds. So I ran to the cinema and sat down, and it took me a second to get into it, because one of the first things that came on screen was Chris, who I'd just been in the car with. I was like, it was a really hard jump into the from the
suspension
reality.
Suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, I was like, oh, no, that's just the guy from the car just now. But I did get into it, and it blew me away, and... From speaking to Chris and to Florence Pugh about it, it felt like it was a real team effort. Or was that the feeling on set? Obviously, it was William's first, his directorial debut.
Yeah.
And it felt like, rather than overcompensating, and there was a lot of new people in there, on with a lot of experienced people, but it seemed like, I don't know, it felt like everyone just came together on a project like that.
Yeah, like, I think that everybody was united in knowing that Alice had done this amazing adaptation, and basically that was good just on its own.
Yeah.
And then it was cool to see how they had, in terms of like the production structure, made it. They'd made it very simple so as not to kind of like, I don't know, like they did it within their means just in this one location. And it was just, so you knew it was the real deal when you showed up, because it all felt very real. And it was all a big kind of first thing for all of us. So, yeah. And it was, I mean, that was seems like a million years ago for me now. But I know it was only like a few days ago, or years ago, but...
It's mad, though, because it wasn't your debut, but it did feel like your breakthrough. And was that ability to immerse yourself in it key to that? Like, from speaking to Florence, as she was saying at times, and you know, what happened to Florence Pugh? She's
doing amazing.
Vanished off the face of the earth. She's smashing it. But
smashing.
She was saying that you would sleep in the barn sometimes and all sorts of stuff and really throw yourself into it. So was that key for a role like that and a film like that?
For Sebastian, it was kind of, yeah, it was like, I suppose part of it's because just thinking about it logically as though you've never heard anything about usual artistic processes.
Yeah.
It was, which is how I think about it, the same as it was with music as well and whatever, because, you know, our generations have been fortunate and been able to, like, kind of happen upon these sort of crafts and whittle away at them as they please at their own pace and their own manner. And so, like, with acting, I was kind of like, well, if the character is who I read him as, then it would be helpful to the overall process to keep yourself in a similar level of discomfort,
yeah,
and pain, both with regards to the practical circumstances of the fictional time it was set in. Like,
yeah,
you know, bedding wouldn't have been that good, duvets.
Of course.
You know, and just doing whatever possible. I really like that part of the job because it gives you a legitimate reason to be doing things which would otherwise be, you know, called, what's it called, self-neglect, or yeah, just generally stupid.
Yeah, it's great. Like, it's really logical to me as well, because it removes one job from your list.
Absolutely.
Like, you don't have to act uncomfortable because you slept in a barn. You are uncomfortable.
Yeah, your,
like,
back's, you can, fucked.
Yeah.
You're cold. You've probably got a cold.
Yeah.
You know, your throat's messed up. You have zero self-worth, zero self-esteem.
Yeah.
And you're unsure of what today will bring, just like the characters usually who are being written about or presented or who've chosen to be portrayed are going through themselves.
Yeah. And it leaves you space to focus on other parts of it. Like, you've got those bits ticked off rather than, yeah, well, as you said, like, your back's fucked. You don't have to be thinking, I need to be a little bit awkward on my right leg because my back's throwing my spine,
yeah,
off. It's like, no, it really has. So I can just play that.
Yeah, it frees you. Frees me. I can't speak for everybody,
yeah,
obviously, but it frees me to be able to just kind of like then just focus on the presentness of everything and reacting and acting and being there both emotionally and cognitively with the other person and all that shit. Because like you say, it frees up a whole other area of what would otherwise become work.
Yeah. So how was it? Because that must have been a reasonably long and uncomfortable time. Because it was all cold, windy, rainy.
Yeah,
you guys were proper, again, from speaking to Florence, everyone just chipped in that you had.
Absolutely.
The dressing rooms were a room in this abandoned house that was cold, had a heater in the corner.
And what those guys were going through too, like Naomi as well, with,
yeah,
both having to put those corsets on and wire them, like, strap themselves in every day. It was just a slog. But it wasn't that long.
Right.
I can't remember exactly how long it was. It,
yeah,
wasn't that long.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about it was is that in any downtime that was available, you were there anyway.
Yeah.
Just kind of watching it, you know, and there was so many other departments that, you know, they were all legends. So
yeah,
if I had nothing to do, I would work with them if insurance would allow it, of course. But, you know, whatever. It was great to just be in the mix with everybody.
I'm massive on that. I've banged on about it on the podcast loads, so I won't go on too much.
But
with every TV show I've done and every film, when they've wrapped me, I kind of ask if I can just hang about, because why do I want to go and sit in a hotel room,
yeah,
and watch Inception again or Limitless or whatever's on hotel room TVs all the time?
And wait until the moment comes where you have to go back downstairs and ask for another sachet of coffee.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I'd rather just hang out on set. And because, again, I didn't go to a drama schools or any of this kind of thing, it's like, I want to learn off these people.
Exactly.
And if you've got Chris Fairbank,
yeah,
on set, it's like, I want to stay here with this dude as long as I can.
Yeah, it's the same. Like, for me, seeing the older, the more senior or experienced actors,
yeah,
and especially in the very early days of me, just watching not just how they worked, but also how they were in themselves when they worked, was so, like, because, you know, when I was first starting out, I was like, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah.
And I mean, I still am, but
completely.
But you know, like, to see somebody, I was like, how do those guys get to that level where they can come to work and not be like perturbed by anything, and they just do it, even if it's like, you know, the best education I ever had was starting to work.
Yeah, just observation on the job. On the first ever gig I had a scene, and there was a guy I was in the scene with who was kind of new as well, and he kept moaning to me because we were just in the background, and he was expecting to have dialogue and all this. And I looked over, and Aidan Gillen off The Wire and off so many good things, an actor I really love, he was just in the background as well. So I was like, I'm going to ignore this angry guy next to me and focus on what that dude's doing, because he's a huge, like, he's an actor I look up to massively, and he's just in the background. So it was watching people like that and observing and going, all right, I see what he's doing there. I see that he's got his own story going on, but it's not imposing on anyone else, and all that kind of thing. And yeah,
that's fascinating, isn't it? The way that somebody can have their own thing going on that doesn't impose on anybody else and isn't needed for the overall process, but is also absolutely essential for the overall process.
It's one of the things I've learned, because it makes it all more enjoyable for you. Because if you are in the background and they're doing 25 takes of this bit of dialogue, you're going to get bored. Whereas if you've given yourself a storyline that, again, isn't imposing anyone else, then you can be playing that out each time and living it each time, rather than thinking, I wonder what's on lunch today. Yeah. I wonder what time we're going to wrap.
Yeah.
All that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's great to learn off people like that. So did you find there were people that you were learning with as well? So rather than those you particularly learnt off, because, again, I always heard that William, the director, was very much, look, this is my first thing. I need you all to work with me here. If I'm doing something wrong, mention it. It might work. If you've got an idea, then let's work together. So was it good to have people that are also kind of developing?
Yeah. William's, like, the best thing about working with him was he was really encouraging and non-encouraging, not in like a modern way of how the connotations of the word modern have, I've mixed up all my words.
Encouragement
have, like, it means something, it can mean, you know, encouragement.
Yeah.
But he was just like pretty encouraging. He'd just be like, he'd want you to find the truth of the thing. And if you did have a query, he'd always be there. But also being an observer as we were free to play things out, which was damn great.
Yeah, I love that. So how was it on that one? Because I often think these things can, or particularly in these industries, everything can feel huge, and then they happen, and your life doesn't change.
I've learned that.
And this must have felt like a big role, a big project, and then it came out, and it was critically acclaimed and adored. But did you kind of have that kind of slight drop in after you're like, I'm waiting for it to come out, it comes out?
Yeah, I got into it so late. Like, I remember when I first attempted starting knocking on agents' doors, and I was already like, dude, you're like nearly 30. Well, I was like, I must have been early 20s. I can't remember now. But even then, I was like, I'm too old.
I was early 30s, like legit, and I'm hassling agents and casting directors and all that for the first time. Yeah.
But I didn't know how any of the structure of the business work. I mean, I still don't, but I was like, so an agent is like, looks after actors, then okay, and then some people have managers, and then but is the agent the judge of the quality of the work, or do they just want you to get work even if it's shit? It took me so long to get my head around that, especially after starting out with music, and how all of the, you know, nefarious shit that goes on there.
It's an interesting transition, isn't it? Because in music, there's so much that feels like you're self-managed, self-controlled, you're the master of your own destiny within reason. And then in acting, it can't be that. There's so many people who have to have an input and have to have a say. It can be a really confusing process. So how was that when it finally came out? And then Was there tons of job offers all of a sudden, or was there?
You know, it was nothing. It was unremarkable. It was very unremarkable. It was just, it's like a slow. It's like any. I guess it's like any other job or any other thing. Like, it was just carry on the way you came from. You know,
yeah,
sort of thing.
Changes.
There was that bit of a like, oh shit, like, you know. But the thing is, that's good, because to keep the value of the mainstream pat on the back, or the kind of added self-worth that having great work readily available at all times, like, yeah, it's good to keep that minimal, because at the end of the day, like, it is, I don't know, like, it's the same with music, isn't it? It's like, nobody really knows why any work's good, and it doesn't detract from your capacity as an artist if you lack mainstream pats on backs.
Yeah, completely. And it can, although it seems that you spend half your career chasing those mainstream pats on the back, they can be the most confusing things to your artistic process, because despite them being a mainstream pat on the back, it's still people, it's still humans embracing it. So again, like, people can say, I'm an artist, I don't care what the industry thinks, but you do care what people think. You care if an audience is embracing it. So if it has this big push, then you're then left questioning, well, why did that work?
Yeah.
What was I doing in that? Because you weren't thinking at the time of creating that, oh, this is my big mainstream thing.
But that's the thing, because then the minute that you start looking for those attributes that amazing work had, that was, like, you know, backed up and everything, and then start trying to emulate them, you're in a bit of a pickle, because
it's never gonna
work. You're stagnant and,
yeah,
you know, like, I always think about how Paul McCartney must feel every time he's got to play, like, you know, Blackbird or something, like, still.
Yeah.
Like, it's hot. The way that old works as well can just haunt you. Oh, God.
Completely. It's a bizarre one, because, again, what people, particularly, I mean, going on the music front now, particularly if you're a touring musician, you know that you're hearing that song every night.
Mm.
Yet the audience, that's the first time they've got to hear it live.
Yeah.
And they might not again for 6 months. So it means the world to them, and you have to try and find that in your performance, in making it mean the world to you, despite the fact you perform it. It's one that you've been doing for years, and you want them to hear the new material that you're hyped about, but you also need to give them that one that means the world to them that they don't get to hear every night,
I guess.
So it's a weird process of combination. But I think I always try and highlight it and talk about it when I can, because I think we really build up the path to big moments in careers and lives, and we never talk about the actual impact. And it can be really disheartening when you get one of those and you think your life is going to change, and then you wake up the next morning and you go, all right, so I've had a film out now.
I'm still a bum with no bed sheets.
There's still nothing going on. So how was your approach to roles after that? Because again, there's two schools of thought on this. Stephen Graham always said to me that if he was a decorator, if someone asked him to decorate a house, he'd go and decorate that house. He'd do his job. He wouldn't be going, I'm not really sure about that house. I don't know if it's the house for me to
fair play
to decorate. But then equally, there has to be some selectiveness. Like, you look at, there's certain people's careers you look over and you go, wow, they look, literally everything they did was a work of art. There's not that kind of up and down bit, but you can't predict that ahead of the project, you know.
No,
you don't know until it's done.
I hear the analogy is really good, but then also that depends on your standards of living, because if you have malleable standards of living and you don't, like, you know, for example, I don't know, have a TV or an Xbox or whatever, or you make your own coffee before you leave. If you add up all them cheapskate things that I do, then it means that you can hold out a little bit longer.
Yeah.
for a script that's really might be really like an artistically worthy, you know, pilgrimage.
Yeah. So how has that been? After something that was so critically acclaimed, and again, the performances and the direction and the writing was all just rightfully praised with Lady Macbeth, how's it been choosing roles since then? Because again, you can take that reservation and you can wait and you can pick the right thing, but you still don't know what it's going to be I mean, even by the time you get on set, let alone by the time it's been edited, mm-hmm. and by the time it's out, and by the time there's been changes.
You're a different person by then.
Yeah.
Your life's completely different.
So how have you found kind of traversing that? Because it's...
Well, yeah. I took the... Yeah, it was weird, just totally weird. Because you, like, blow all of this, and, it, like, you give everything to this thing, and then you leave everything, and then, like, years go by, and then that's the last kind of quality control, you know, that you might be able to do on what you do for work. So that's one part of it.
Yeah.
But then, I guess, just in terms of the actual work, the rate of self-education is just exponential and continues to be. And it actually makes things better because, you know, even though I still like to try to do the kind of work that I think is decent, then I can also have a little bit less stress. Like, because before, it was the point where I would turn up for a job and I'd just be like, oh crap. Like, I would be like, you know, I'm there, I'm going to do it. But the more you do, the more it is familiar. Like, the process becomes familiar.
Yeah.
So, but it's still really weird, isn't it? It's just a weird job.
It's getting the balance, I guess. Stephen Knight is someone that's blown me away as a writer because he seems to have his projects that he writes and he show runs and it's everything. He's so involved in everything and it's his heart and soul. Mm. But then he has his projects he writes and then hands off to someone else. And he seems good at relinquishing that control and that emotional attachment. And a lot of those things he writes and hands off become absolutely amazing. Mm. But some of them, I'm sure, aren't what he wanted them to be or aren't the vision he had. But he seems to have that balance of here's the ones that are just a job and here's the ones that I'd die for. Like, this is my everything. And I think that's something to aspire to at times, because equally you can't, it'd be hugely mentally and physically taxing if every job you got was the one that you're having to pull yourself apart for. And
but that's a good thing. It would be taxing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But there are ways of it'd be a process of learning and working a lot, I guess. But there's a way of keeping that balance. I hate that word balance. But
it's true though, man. It's
keeping that stuff balanced, you know.
So how was it when Peaky Blinders came along? Because I think that's a great series, and I thought your role and your performance in that was absolutely fantastic. It blew me away. Your approach to it, it was so. And it's something that we'll talk about in Calm with Horses, because it's so fragile, but also so dangerous and deadly and kind of explosive as such. So how was that to join a show like that and be part of that?
It was mental.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. I hadn't watched it, but I was well aware. I have this problem where if something becomes legendary, I just don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah, I feel you.
And so I was like that with that. In fact, and it's gone to the point where I'm pretty much just like that with any technology and modern streaming, all of it. I'm just like, nah.
Because
everyone likes it, so, you know, I'll get a CB radio as if or whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when I first heard of it, I was like, whoa, that's pretty cool. And then the scene itself and Barney, I really liked that it was kind of self-contained.
Yeah.
And because usually I'm scared of TV. Not scared, but scared.
In what way?
Because there's so much of it.
Yeah.
And I think back to the old days with music and how that got completely reinvented. And it's, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's just something that I'm just a bit wary of, because there's just so much stuff being made all the time on every subject for every demographic.
Yeah.
It gets to the point where I find myself wishing that it was more like the old days when you'd save up and then go see one of a few films that you really wanted to see. And then you'd, you know, really, and they would be works of standalone genius or even standalone, you know, what's the word, mediocrity, but still the choice. It's like when you go to the cornflake aisle and it's like there's a bazillion different kinds of cornflakes, and you're like, well, do we need this many different kinds of breakfast cereal, you know?
It's it, it the comparison to music is a really clear one, because it's the devaluing of it. It's, again, I completely remember as a teen saving up to buy that one album that month or that couple of months and listening to that album inside and out, whereas now, because we've got everything available on Spotify or wherever else, I don't think people are doing that. It's easy to jump onto the next thing. And
the notion of checking something out now is totally different from what it was when I was a kid. Like, the notion is just like, oh, I'll have a look at what that is. Like, you'd have to invest in it or go through secondhand vouchers in your social circles to get me like, oh, yeah, you know, there's this band.
Yeah.
Like, whatever. It's Rage Against the Machine. You know, when you're a kid, have you heard them? Like, yeah, oh, whoa, Rage Against the Machine. Sweet. Maybe I'll check them out because, you seem like a cool dude and I like, we skate together. So I'll have a poke, see what it's like. That kind of thing. Now you can just check anything out anytime, anywhere.
And you don't have to even fully check it out. You can check out the first few seconds as you're doing something else.
You can skim while you're on the John.
And that is a worry with TV, because I think Netflix and Amazon, I think, again, I'm a fan of them. I really am, but I do worry as well, because there will be things that I watch and think are absolutely amazing, and in a month I'm thinking, oh, what was that show that I watched?
Yeah.
But, and it's because of that. I love that I get to consume, and particularly, again, if you're trying to learn an industry, if you're trying to learn from great people, to watch great TV is an amazing gift. But, yeah, even with that, I genuinely have it all the time going, I saw something earlier this year that I loved, but I can't place it. So,
and also another thing that's contributed to that is this, like, there's such a readily available library of previous aesthetics from historical artistic works, whether it's music or film.
Yeah.
And so now I feel like it's more difficult to judge whether something's decent based on the aesthetic that it immediately presents, because everybody has access to that quality of production now.
Yeah.
And something can look beautiful and pristine and look like it has some like credible undertones of artistic anguish, but that's just because it's 2020 and everything looks fucking great.
Yeah, and they can put a filter on it that makes it look deep and meaningful and gritty.
And the cameras are like at the best they've ever been and stuff like that. But but then you look at it and you're like, actually, there's no core to this. Like, this doesn't have the same emotional or philosophical undertones that things that I'm used to seeing being presented this way are not, or things that usually are presented this way are usually known to have, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, Peaky was sick. It was mental to work with that. It was a really like a step up to the plate sort of thing for me in my mind, and it was just great to work with them all. They were sick.
Exciting one. And did you mentioned the kind of the isolation of the role, and it's one of the things I think was great. Like, I remember speaking to Riz Ahmed after he'd done his Star Wars film, because we used to rap together sick back in the day, and he'd done this Star Wars, and I watched it and I was like, mate, you've absolutely nailed it, because you've been part of this huge franchise, but it's a standalone, and spoiler alert, his character dies, everyone dies, so it's kind of perfect, because it's not one of them where you get on board with Star Wars and it's exciting, but that's your career for the next 10-15 years. You literally can't really do anything else, and I think he nailed it in that. And it's similar with your character in Peaky. And again, spoiler alert here, but he dies. So you get to go and be part of this huge thing, but then leave. I was speaking to Anthony Byrne, the director, about it, and he was saying that him and Stephen were really into your performance, into your character.
Oh, Anthony, yeah, legend.
And, and Stephen said, you know, should we not kill him off? Like, should we keep him in? And Anthony was like, we need to kill him off. Like, we need someone to, like,
well,
it's key to it that this character is this rich and someone that the audience is going to be like, oh, I want to hear more from him. And then bang.
One day on the set, Stephen Knight came up to me and approached me. and I'd never met him before, but I could tell in that moment, because somebody left like a circle and said bye Stephen. I was like, fuck, that's him.
That's the dude.
And then he came up to me and he was like, oh yeah, I really like Barney. And I was like, oh, thank you, Mr. Knight. Yeah. And then he goes, maybe we don't, you know, maybe we don't have to, maybe he doesn't have to die. And I was like, oh, what? I was well looking forward to getting shot in the face. And then later on I realised that that might have been one of those, like, stories where you just mess up your future prospects.
No, man, I think I genuinely think it's absolutely key. I had a thing, so I work on a Stephen Knight thing called Taboo, and there was a point where they were kind of debating someone had to be killed, and tons of people were saying, no, it wouldn't be my character. It would be my... because a character had to be the kind of the grass or the snitch who'd gone behind people's back. And I kind of looked at my character and I was like, look, my character would do that. My character hasn't got any loyalty to the main leads of the show. He would be looking out for himself and the guy he's the right-hand man to. And I didn't end up getting killed, but it impressed people that I cared more about the story than career or my... Do you know what I mean? And it's the same with Barney. He had to die.
He had to die. He's so good
that he died. You know, you could have, if you'd been career-minded in that moment and gone, yeah, I've got a lot of ideas for him and this and that, then it wouldn't have been the same character, wouldn't have had that same impact.
Exactly. The fact that he died after all of that was established in that initial scene, that's why Mr. Knight is great, is because he has the balls to do things like that. And life is like that. People like set off to do things and then they just get shot in the face.
It's why I love it when stuff is based on true stories, on real people, particularly crime stuff, because you can't do the... You will have that thing. There was it was an Australian crime thing, Underbelly. There was a really good Australian crime thing that was all based on a load of stuff that had happened. And to the extent that when it came out, it wasn't allowed to be aired in a certain part of Australia because the court cases were still going on.
What?
So they were worried about it influencing juries or things like that. And in that, it was great because you'd have a character in a couple of episodes, you'd be like, this guy's going to be the star. He's amazing. He's so enigmatic, so charismatic. And then, bang, he's dead. Yeah. And it's like, if it wasn't true story, that character, as soon as they started filming him, they would have gone, we're going to keep this guy. He's going to be series three. He's going to be the main guy. He's going to become the new boss. But no, they have to go. And that's what Stephen's amazing at.
Yeah.
Not writing in, here's a character that we're going to kill, so let's just put him in there to be killed. He'll put him in there to make the audience care about him, to make the audience love him, and then go, well, as it happens,
and he's gone. It's also amazing how, like, he can keep things ambiguous, but not that annoying brand of ambiguous, which is I see a lot of nowadays. Like, Stephen Knight's brand of ambiguous, when it regards to, like, somebody's inner workings and stuff like this, usually his lead characters, it's like, it's cool because you're still totally involved and you're rooting for them, but you kind of know, in some case, some of his characters, like, you're just like, it's never on the nose enough to look like it's trying to fit into the skin of a film or narrative format, you know, 100%. Like how they usually do. Like, you know, when the first person that you see, this person, okay, well, judging by the light, I'd say this person is my protagonist, you know?
Yeah. But then again, it's giving that respect to almost everyone, because a thing that I always kind of try and focus on in acting is that in the real world, everyone is the protagonist in their story.
Yeah.
So every character on that screen, in their head, is the fucking protagonist, is the lead character. So why not present in that way?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's great. But anyway, I'd let's get on to talking about Calm with Horses, because it felt like Barney almost informed the character of Arm a little bit. I don't know what the timing was of filming.
I can't even remember now.
But they were both kind of really, as I said, delicate people, kind of clearly with some trauma in their lives and some mental health issues and stuff like that, but both also kind of being used as a weapon.
Yeah, pawns in some way, yeah.
So
I never thought of that.
So how was it to get that character of Arm in Calm with Horses? Because the cast is amazing. I remember when they were putting it together, I was on Shaheen Baig's case constantly, because I was like, look at what this looks amazing. This is going to be the best. So how was that to get that role and to find that character?
I mean, getting the role was like, you know, I was like, this is never going to happen again instantly. Yeah. So I was like, you know, needs to be nailed in every sense of the word.
It was another directorial debut, right?
Nick Rowland's first. I mean, to be fair, though, his shorts that he made before are brilliant.
And
it almost looks like somebody who's been directing feature films for a long time then just decided one year, I'm going to make a short, you know? Yeah, that's what the short that I saw of his looked like. But it was his first feature film, and it was weird because we were all quite a similar age group, like me, Nick, and the producer, Dan, and you know, obviously hungry, late 20s hungry.
Yeah.
So that was cool to be in a boat like that with those guys. But yeah, I mean, getting it was just like, you know, full steam ahead then. After that, it was just my whole life became doing that. And then, thank you, Shaheen.
So how was it finding your tone on that character? Because what I really liked was he's not a fucking idiot. He's not a fool. He's got an innocence and things like that. But he's there's a lot of layers to him and a lot of depth in there. And it would have been easy to play the kind of, the idiot meathead who's being used and being pushed around and being used as a pawn. But there was far more to it than that. And we saw that with some of the scenes with Neve and some of the scenes with
the
kid in it. It was an amazing cast. Absolutely amazing. So, how did you go from what was on the page to what you presented in front of camera?
Well, the amazing thing about the writing of it was it was like had a lot of qualities that Stephen Knight's stuff had where you can tell that every word chosen to be spoken by any character has a reason to be there, and it's all consistent with the environment that it's supposedly taking place in. There was a lot to do, but the structure of everything was fine. So then it was just like, I had this mate from back home called Steve. I won't give a second. Steve. And he was a bit... I instantly recognised something in him that could be the grounding of my understanding of how I was reading Arm.
Right.
And, he's not stupid. He's switched on in ways I'll never be switched on. And he's physically powerful. But then he would easily be somebody who you could just, like, if you were, you know, nastily minded, you could convince him to, you know, help you move house all day while you sat and do tea, just drink tea, you know, reading the paper, and he's been there for 6 hours, like carting your armchairs out or whatever. So I was like, that is something that I've met, and I've seen a lot of people that I've met throughout my life, and so it was important then to not fall for the protagonist, the male lead thing, I guess, like not make him like an action hero seeming dude
completely,
you know, like justify that he had to be as plausible as the whole the relationship with Neve, Ursula, and his son. All of that had to be not I felt responsible for helping that to not be mistaken for a trope in a thriller.
Yeah.
I mean, not responsible. I just felt it could. I was aware that it could have gone that way.
The way.
I'll just try and give the Steve-ness to it.
Had you enjoyed kind of the transformation for roles? Because I think from what you're saying there, a key part to the character in many ways was letting the physicality cover here's the action. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Not playing the character, but because of that, you had to bulk up. You looked huge for it. So it's that kind of, how was that? The transformation and obviously it's Irish, so the accent. Yeah. Was that something that you enjoy kind of going, right, I need to build this character rather than I need to play this character. I need to build them as well.
Yeah. For me, that was the first part of the practical task. The rest of it, the emotional side of it was, acting. the acting part of it was not my initial worry. It was those things like that you're describing, the things that I tried get locked in place before, and you know, the doing all of that stuff, that was the bare minimum that he needed aesthetically in terms of the voice, in terms of the build and the posture. Yeah. Like, so that, and then as I was doing that work, I just played around with being in it for as long as possible until I no longer felt any worry about having to do like a scene, because that stuff would just be already on me.
Yeah, I love that. How was it working? Because your character has a great relationship or a key relationship, not great at all, with Barry Kerrigan, who's been on the podcast as well. And he blew me away just talking to him in person. I'd watched him in a lot of stuff. I loved Love Hate. I loved Killing of the Sacred Deer. I've been a fan of him.
Yeah.
But meeting him and realising he's just a lad off the estates.
He's just a
proper little scally. And it's...
I know.
Yeah, it's perfect.
I felt the same way, because when I first saw him, I was like, who's that kid?
Yeah.
Like, and then I met him, and it was like, I was expecting some, like, I don't know what I was expecting, but then he's just like, all right, I'm Barry.
He's done quite arty films, so I'd always assumed he was a bit of a drama school kid, a bit, you know, all that. And then he's not. He's just a proper little lad.
Yeah, he's just grafting.
Yeah.
And that's it. And it's so funny, because I think a lot of people probably thought that, but he's just not like that. He's the most down-to-earth dude, or one of the most down-to-earth dudes I've ever worked with. And he's constantly cracking jokes.
I was going to say, is that key? Is the relationship off screen key to getting the relationship right on screen as well? Because it felt like they had to have a genuine friendship so that it isn't just obvious that he's exploiting the big guy who'll move his whole house for him as he drinks tea if he wants to.
Yeah, totally. We just, I think subconsciously you just do it anyway when you arrive on a job.
Yeah.
You break down the superficial barriers that you socially... Well, I don't know. I don't always do it. I mean, it doesn't really matter. But in this film, because of the nature of it, and because we were all out there, and because there was a lot of discussion about how things might go down and things like this, we all just got pretty busy pretty quickly with just getting to know each other. And Barry had his girlfriend with him, so we were all just, you know, chatting, and we'd see each other. Like, it was impossible not to see each other, because every time you come in the hotel, there was somebody waiting in the entrance.
Yeah,
And then you'd go get, like, some bangs and mash or a pint or something.
Yeah, I love it. So, I mean, obviously, in Lady Macbeth, you worked with Florence, who's gone on to just absolutely smash it.
Astro.
Neve feels like she's next.
She's smashing
in The Virtue, she was absolutely amazing. And then all of a sudden, Calm with Horses, she's equally just mind-blowing, her performance. Because, again, it would have been easy to go into tropes there of the angry ex or the put-upon single mother. But
Neve totally makes it real, like she's the real deal.
The scene of you guys in the diner is just, for both the characters, it's just so perfect to give that extra level and depth and dimension of you switching back into... It feels like there's a real history because you switch into the past, rather than what we've seen so far, where she's having to be strong for the kids and she's annoyed at the absent father as such.
Yeah, yeah.
There's that moment there where you're teenagers on a first date again, and it's fucking, it's great. So how was that to find those moments and those relationships with someone like me?
It was great. I mean, we hung out before, like I think we both knew that we had to, but in hanging out, we just got on really well anyway.
Great.
And, you know, it's weird because you sit down with this intention of trying to know somebody to maybe better serve the portrayal, but then you end up like just chewing shit, you know, for ages. And that was really cool, because then it doesn't seem as much like work. And at the same time, as you're talking about all of these things about like your life and this place that we're in now and all this stuff, like you still don't really exchange anything solid about the work, like in terms of, you know, you're not exchanging how we're going to do this.
Here's our plan.
What about that scene? Here's our plan. We're not like, there's none of that. You're just, you know that when it kicks off, it'll kick off. And the time for that to happen is when it happens. And everything in the meantime is just the most that you can be doing to guarantee that that is a slick operation.
And again, I think it can be overlooked because I'm the same. I'm not always Mr. We're on set, let's socialise and all that kind of thing. It can vary from job to job, but when you have that, it just means subconsciously you're more comfortable when you are on set to go places that you might not have been comfortable otherwise. Do you know what I mean? Even if you're not spending that time socially working on the character and planning the scene, it means you're getting so comfortable with each other that when you do need to go, right, here's where I'm going on this.
Yeah, there's nothing holding you back at all. But also, like, as I've continued to work, I've realised that some people are better acquainted with that ability than others, and I'm like, it's taken work on my part to get to understand that once you have the, you've been vouched for in terms of getting a job, and so nobody's gonna say if you do go full whack, don't go full whack, unless it's a directorial note. Nobody's gonna want you to hold back for like etiquette's sake or something like that, like, sorry, etiquette in the real world's sake, you know. And it took me a while to realize that, and I mean, I think it's just part of getting older as well. You just generally give less fucks, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, when I had Vicky McClure on the podcast, she talked about how in Mrs. England, where when her and Johnny Harris had these brutal scenes, that they kind of had to agree beforehand that just everything's all right and we'll deal with it at the end of the day. Because they couldn't end every scene by going, oh, I'm sorry, is that...
Absolutely.
Is everything okay? You couldn't apologise and break out of it. You had to go, just walk away from each other and come back and do it again, because it wouldn't have worked if every time you're having that, as I said, that etiquette issue of I've gone full whack and then you go cut. And again, it's a completely natural and human thing that as soon as it's cut, you're like... Was that okay? I'm sorry if that was, if I grabbed you too hard or if I went too far. It's like, that's not going to help anything if that's in your head, I guess.
Yeah, well, I did a film called Farming, and I had a small part in that, and it was brutal because we had to be these like terribly, terribly racist people and do terribly, terribly horrible things to the character that Damson Idris was playing. And it's shit because I had this impulse to just be like, dude, I'm so fucking sorry.
Yeah.
Right? Or like, or, you know, if, is it all right if I, you know, strangle you a bit harder or whatever the fuck?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then that was not helpful for him and his work on that day. And so it's such a weird job. It's just a weird job.
It's exactly as you said at the start. It kind of comes full circle as we're coming to the end of the chat. It's giving you less that you have to fake.
Mm.
If you're strangling him a bit much, he's going to let you know, and that's good.
Yeah.
Because that's how... And again, that's not to say that you should be dangerous on set or anything like that, but it all adds to it. And it's all like adds to the...
There's an actor called Frederick Schmidt. He's amazing, and I had a small part of the thing with him once, and he the amount that he was strangling me, I was just someone who, like, I was playing someone who broke into his house. The amount he was strangling me made my performance good.
Yeah.
Like, it was great.
Completely. It's easier. A Willem Dafoe in The Lighthouse
recently. I still need to see that.
It's great, but there's a bit where... Essentially, it's not a big spoiler, but essentially someone's trying to bury him alive. And they literally just started to bury him alive. And he said afterwards, he was like, that was perfect because I didn't have to act. I felt really uncomfortable and scared. And there was soil going in my mouth.
So wow.
I was terrified. And the performance is mind-blowing. But it's like, yeah, that's because we just did it. And he's an old school kind of drama guy, kind of, so he's really immerse yourself and all that kind of thing. And it's
That's why sometimes it's so laughable, the amount of new discipline, the new kind of bureaucracies that contaminate processes like this, because it's like between the health and safety and the insurance and the everything, it's like it makes finding authenticity, which is free, costly.
I was sitting at home the other day after a day on set for a thing, and I started to rub my head, and I was like, oh man, I've got a spot coming up. This is terrible. I'm filming again tomorrow. And I realised, no, I just had a lump on my head because I'd been headbutting the door in every scene. and I'd been going to, in the moment, I hadn't really given a shit, but I'm sitting at home watching TV going, oh, that's a weird... Oh, no, I've been headbutting the door all day. No, but that's because that's what...
constantly. I've literally.
You don't have to fake that. Fake an impact of you kind of pretending to. It's like, no, just.
The amount of disclaimers I've got from from producers who are like, I, Cosmo Jarvis, you know, agree that nobody asked me to smash my knuckles against the container. Nobody asked me to hit my head against the bar, whatever it is, but it's like. And I remember once we were doing this act of Phil Ettinger, like, he hit me and him out of the scene and he hit a wall and his fist went straight through the wall and missed a piece of, you know, like the reinforcing rod kind of things in concrete. He missed one of them by like an inch. And if he'd have hit it with the velocity that he threw that punch, he would have smashed his knuckles to pieces. And immediately after the take, he was like, that was such an actor thing to do.
completely. Now, well, I mean, there's tons I want to talk about, but I'll wrap things up as we're on the hour mark. I just want to kind of ask, what was this always your dream? Like, what kind of kid were you? Were you looking at acting or music or anything in between? Yeah. Or what did you think as a kid? What was your goals and dreams?
Like everybody, I had a pretty unusual upbringing.
Yeah.
And from a young age, I was always making things and doing things and trying to master creative processes because it was nice because they're so intangible and actually pretty much so meaningless, depending on which way you look at it. I love art, but I also know it's just, you know, cave paintings, it's just squiggles, the beautiful squiggles, but squiggles. And
yeah.
Same with acting and same with music and all that. But at the same time, I quite like the idea of trying to bring a codifiable sort of discipline to something that is incrementable, totally ridiculous.
Yeah,
that was always an appealing idea, and as I grew up, I realised it was kind of just a coping mechanism because of the state I was when I was younger. But it was always something that I wanted to keep working at, and that, like, music was the first one because living in Devon, like, acting just isn't an option.
It's not on the list, is it?
You live in the middle of country bumpkin land, you know, you're like, you're screwed. But then luckily, I don't fully hate and regret what I did with music because it meant that I could have a small chance at getting to be able to knock on that first agent's door.
Mm.
But it is always something that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Because I always felt like my old man should have been an actor, but he wasn't because he was from a different generation where, you know, you get sent off to the Merchant Navy when you're very illegally young. And so, you know, that was from his school, but I'm, you know, my mum and my dad introduced me to all this amazing stuff and so then I was like, and by the time I realized it was probably just because I was inept at doing anything else, academic or, you know, it was already too late by the time I realised that. I'm 30. What am I going to do? I'm screwed now. Just got to keep going.
Yeah. So what is ahead? Is there a plan? Is there a... Because, again, obviously, a project like Calm with Horses, it's because it would have been low budget as well and independent, it's hard to get these fucking things even in cinemas, let alone anyone out to see them. But it will have been a project that's been a lot of work for everyone involved for a long time, and now it's about to come out, and hopefully people are going to see it. So what's next? Is it the kind of you wake up and nothing's changed, or is it you've done that once and now you know, here's what I want to do, here's my motivation?
I mean, yeah, I think it'll be more of that unremarkable sort of feeling and just a case of, like, unfortunately, like, once the more work you get, I mean, you don't have to, like... It's interesting what you said earlier about, like, you know, guy who's the plumber would just take every job because that is true. And I'm always using analogies for this craft or creative crafts that are based in how people with more practical work go about defining their work. Like, you know, at the end of the day, you try and just do good work like anybody would. But unfortunately, I have to be a little bit more picky because I don't want to do the same thing twice, and I want to keep the people that I'm portraying different from each other in as many aspects as is possible. But it's like, you just got to go roll with the punches, I guess. I have no immediate... I have so many, like, aims and projections and stuff, but I also have none. And that's cool. And at the minute, it's just a case of, you know, don't die by any avoidable circumstances. I'll be happy with that.
That's the perfect approach and outlook. And it seems to be working. As said, Lady Macbeth was on my films of the year list that year, and Calm with Horses was the first film this year that made me go, fuck, that was, yeah, it's just amazing.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
The balance of beauty and brutality was just, I've not seen that work so well in a long time. So, yeah, thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure speaking. Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely to speak to you and meet you and everything.
No problem at all. Thank you, man.
Legend.
Here we go.
I have my addictions and they have me.
Yeah, damn right. Oh, wicked. Oh, no. Yeah.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Cosmo. I hope you enjoyed that. I'll be back next week, as ever, keeping the outro nice and brief here. If you're a fan of podcasts, then go and check out Pod Bible magazine. But the key takeaway from this is go and see Calm with Horses. It's wicked. Thank you all for tuning in. I will be back next week. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.